Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Singer-songwriter Alina Simone recently published an op-ed in the New York Times under the title The End of Quiet Music, and it raises some very interesting questions about what it's like to be an independent musician in 2013. Hi, Alina.
Hi, John.
So this whole article is about you and other musicians being kind of forced into being entrepreneurs as well as artists. Is that right?
I'd say so, yeah. My article is sort of about opting out, you know, and making the choice to essentially not make more music or not to record another album. I've had three labels release my music previously. They are now all out of business. So there was this infrastructure when I first started out, you know, about 10 years ago. And it's sort of an entry-level infrastructure of little labels that support emerging artists, and it doesn't really exist anymore. And what's replaced it, for the most part, is Kickstarter.
So let me just back up to something you said a moment ago, which is, and you say this in the article as well, you've opted out, you're not making music anymore. Is it that stark a choice? It's like you either make music and you're the entrepreneur promoting it, or you don't make music. Isn't there a middle ground where you could still be making music and opt out of the business part?
Of course. I mean, I make music at home, and I can, you know, I released on Bandcamp a collection of my raw demos that was just, you know, stuff that I'd recorded over the years that I hadn't put out on any labels. And that, you know, that sold to some folks, and that was nice. So, I mean, I feel like I could make bedroom recordings, and
right.
I could do the sort of thing that doesn't involve the kind of investment that a, you know, full-length, professionally produced album that is marketed to the, you know, marketed nationally or even internationally. That's really what I'm opting out of, not like music or loving music or making
right.
music. Yeah.
Okay, so now with your last album, Make Your Own Danger, did you end up having to do a lot of this stuff yourself?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot myself. I mean, I feel like in the article, since it's a short article, I didn't have room to give a shout out to the folks who helped me, because I do have a great distributor, which is Virtual Label. They're in Brooklyn, and they've got a really interesting model and were incredibly helpful. I did hire a publicist, so I had, you know, help. But still, even with that, I just felt like I was spending so much of my time on business. I was packing every CD and every demo myself. I was going to the post office with garbage bags full of CD mailers. I was dealing with spreadsheets and with manufacturers. And I was like, I don't like this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah. Although some people listening might hear you talking about, you know, the big satchel of CDs over your shoulder, taking to the post office, and think, that's a good problem to have. You could have been going to the post office with one CD and a mailer.
Not every day, John, you know,
right.
but in the beginning.
I understand what you're saying. Alina Simone is here. This is the album that she had to work so hard to make and then to promote, the album called Make Your Own Danger. Well, I'd buy that, but Alina Simone doesn't want to sell it to me.
Wait, that's not true.
I know. The album's Make Your Own Danger. The song is Beautiful Machine. So your op-ed piece in the Times, which was headlined The End of Quiet Music, basically you got into this business to be a musician, not to be a business person. Is that, if I had to put it in a nutshell, is that it?
Right, and then the situation changed. I mean, the landscape changed around me, and it was no longer the, you know, no longer had the same opportunities that I had when I started out.
And just the title, The End of Quiet Music, just to let folks know, usually the newspaper or the magazine comes up with the title, right?
True. I would have called it the right to be quiet, because I feel like that's an important right for musicians to have, the right to their privacy, you know, the right to keep, you know, requests for money even private, the mm-hmm. right to opt out of, you know, selling things all the time.
Lena Simone is obviously with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Are we asking too much of musicians to both make the music, create the art, and to market and promote it as well? You can leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. And joining me as well is Jason King, associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. And Jason, your job is to help prepare young people for a career in music, both the artistic and the business end. What's your response to Alina's article?
Yeah, well, John, that is our role at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. What we're there to do is to bring in students, undergraduate students, who see themselves as artists, but who are also committed to the business of creating and selling recorded music. And so they have to really be comfortable with that marriage of art and business. They take classes in producing, classes in performing, but they also have to learn how to read contracts if they're a performer. They have to know how to empower themselves from a business perspective. And every student who goes through our program actually has to create a full plan for a business that they have to launch, whether it's their own record label or marketing company, that kind of thing. So the students that we have at NYU are already committed to that. They're kind of artists slash entrepreneurs. And I think that's part of what's happened in the music industry of the last 10 to 15 years, that as recorded music has become devalued as a commodity to some degree, more and more artists who have an entrepreneurial spirit are the ones who are rising to the top. So the Pharrell Williams of the world and those kinds of artists who are doing that. I think that what we're basically talking about here is DIY, right? The do-it-yourself spirit, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is as old as recorded music itself. There's always been DIY artists who've had to not just make the music, but also self-promote and push their work. And I think to some degree, that's still what's happening. And I think you can actually help people become better at the DIY process.
Well, you guys are doing that at NYU. You know, at the Juilliard, they're now doing that as well. You know, the classical music kids are also being taught sort of basic business skills to get out there and like survive in what is a very cutthroat business. So, I mean, Alina, the idea of DIY is sort of a, you know, a received tradition. You know, it's a classic way of making art of any form.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that all musicians have that spirit to an extent. I mean, you can't start out without recording something, right, without playing shows, without getting people to your shows. There's so much that you have to do and that musicians do constantly to promote themselves and always have. I think one thing that I worry about is, like, you know, if you think back 10, 20, 30 years, I mean, we had Nirvana, you know, we had artists like Sean Marshall, we had kids who didn't go to college, who played in clubs, who were discovered, who worked very hard, but were not necessarily from the kinds of backgrounds where they had, you know, laptops and, mm-hmm, you know, marketing mm-hmm. savvy, and frankly, the kind of family and friends that could contribute to a Kickstarter. And I think that, you know, we as a society are poorer for not kind of having that entry-level infrastructure there, something for those artists, too, that might not have access to the Kickstarter on, you know, all that stuff.
Well, Matt, you've mentioned Kickstarter a couple of times. This is the fan funding website. Is that not an entry-level? I mean, Jason, do you guys sort of teach that part of the business to the students?
We don't teach a course on Kickstarter at this point, but we definitely identify that as one way in which young people can make money. It's just basically a way to self-finance. Mm-hmm. I think we're in a transitional moment where it's a kind of crude way sometimes to self-finance, because it means you're having a direct appeal on the internet to your fans and saying, please support my album, give me $500 and I'll take you out to lunch or something like that. It's not always the most subtle or right, effective way of self-financing.
But sometimes it can be super effective.
Absolutely.
And Alina, in your article, The End of Quiet Music, you refer to your friend Amanda Palmer, who
yes.
had a very successful Kickstarter campaign, as she described to us when she joined us here in the Soundcheck studio last September.
I started a Kickstarter that lasted the whole month of May, and the Kickstarter goal was $100,000 and ended up making more than $1 million.
Right.
But we had already recorded the record, so basically I went into debt. I borrowed a bunch of money from various people and spent all of my own, and then just hoped and prayed that I would make it back on the Kickstarter, which I did. I'm really not the killing type.
Obviously, Alina, not everybody who goes on Kickstarter makes a gazillion dollars or five times what they ask for. But what for you? What is the what's the turnoff with the whole Kickstarter? Why are you not going that route?
I feel like I'm coming off as anti-Kickstarter. I've probably supported five Kickstarters this year.
Yeah.
Totally not anti-Kickstarter. I mean, and for me, it's not even Kickstarter specifically. It's just sort of looking forward and thinking, you know, I'd like to develop as an artist. I'd like to do more than I did the last time. I'd like to make a better album than I did the last time. That requires, you know, more resources and just sort of more support than I think I can muster myself around myself. I think that in my article, I pointed out this really extraordinary thing happened to me. This editor heard my music on Pandora, this was about 4 years ago, literally went to the now non-existent Virgin Megastore, bought all my albums, and offered me a book deal just because he thought there was something in my music and my lyrics that might translate into prose. And literally for the first time in my life, I was the beneficiary of artistic development. I mean, I had a book sort of commissioned by a guy who thought I had potential. And I was like, wow, this is what it must have been like in like the early days.
The heyday of the music industry.
The heyday of the music industry.
Yeah.
Where someone savvy just hears someone, sees them working hard out in, you know, the live music environment and is like, I'm going to take a chance on you. I'm going to make a reckless bet, you know, or a savvy
bet. That still happens. It happens less than it happened in the past.
Absolutely.
And, you know, on one hand, you have the superstar artists, the small cadre of superstar artists that are being promoted and marketed by major labels. On the other hand, you have everybody else who's trying to make a living on a daily basis doing it. And I think one of the things that's great about your piece is that you identify the kind of loss of a sort of middle class music maker, distributor, the independent labels and so on. It's harder and harder for those kinds of labels and entities to stay afloat in the music industry.
Well, it also seems that, Jason, one of the other points Alina's making, you're sitting right here, but I'm going to put words in your mouth anyway, is that, you know, for those people who by choice or by virtue of how they are personally constructed, find it kind of odd or distasteful or, you know, don't want to be involved in asking for money, you know, via Kickstarter or something.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of digital busking, right? I mean, you're out there directly almost asking people for money. Sometimes even it feels like a kind of panhandling for some. But it can be very successful. It's just that it's Kickstarter and other online fan funding sites. They're one means of raising money. There's so many other ways of raising money. And you also don't have to just do it alone. I mean, entrepreneurship is not just a solo venture. It's something that you can, you know, who's your team? Who's working with you?
Is there someone out there that, you know, that maybe you point out to the kids in the school or could point out to us who is doing it right? Someone who's, you know, doing it themselves, independent, you know, kind of label-free, and yet somehow doing it well.
Well, I think there's a lot of artists who are trying to find their way without a label. Very often artists realize that they can do certain things on their own without a label, but if they want to blow up and have the kinds of careers that they might admire, you know, when they're watching television and listening to the radio and so on, they have to take certain steps to achieve those. So we can look at somebody like an Ingrid Michaelson who, you know, found ways to promote and market her music outside of the traditional label structure, all the way to somebody like Macklemore today, you know, who, you know, also found some interesting ways around the traditional music industry. But at the end of the day, a lot of artists feel that, you know, major labels aren't their enemy necessarily. They're just one way to gain some financing and to get promoted in a way that they probably couldn't do on their own. I had a broken keyboard, I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket, then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game, hell no. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads would be like, ah, he got the Velcro. I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket. We're speaking with Jason King, associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music in New York at NYU, and Alina Simone, the singer and songwriter and now author of two books. There's the memoir, You Must Go and Win, and then there's the new novel called Note to Self. So you, Alina, as you mentioned before, the beneficiary of essentially artist development, A&R, in the publishing industry. Yeah. And so is it your hope that the music industry can get back to that somehow? That they're, I mean, the age of the big record labels being able to swoop down and pluck you out of obscurity and make you a star, as Jason pointed out, they're not entirely gone, but it's largely gone. And there's a lot of people who don't want to go back to that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I make this point in my article, too. But I think from this strange new vantage point I had, suddenly a writer, there were all these opportunities that were available to me that had never been available to me as a singer. You know, grants, residencies, teaching opportunities. There are all these things you could kind of apply for, and mentorship opportunities, just time to think, time to work and make something.
Well, and as you mentioned in the article, you know, the thinking has often been in the philanthropic community, if it's pop music, let the market decide.
Yeah.
But the market has changed utterly in the digital age.
Right. So the question is, why don't these other institutions change as well? I mean, musicians have changed a lot. I mean, people, it's constant, you know, the new technological thingies that we can do to raise money and tell people and run campaigns to incentivize fans and do this and that. But what about the institutions that support culture and the arts? What about, you know, the Guggenheim Foundation? What about the NEA? What about places like NYU that hire people to teach things like creative writing and poetry? Why isn't the craft of songwriting taught alongside those genres?
But we do. We teach all
those
things.
Okay, you do? Yeah, you teach songwriting? I'm sorry.
Yeah. And actually,
I think that's great.
But a lot of universities are doing pop music instruction, right, in certain kinds of ways, and whether it's on the business side or whether it's performance or production and so on. I think that's happening at the university level. There are also, musicians have also been the recipients of all kinds of State Department grants and so on to travel abroad. I think the problem is, you know, would the NEH or the NEA give Beyonce money, you know, for what she's doing? No, because she's a, you know, self-propelling commodity who's already making a lot of money. So right. I think what we're talking about is at the sort of DIY independent level, can those kinds of artists who are aiming for pop music success get funded by state institutions?
Well, I mean, I think that to my mind, there's no difference between like a Jonathan Franzen and an Elliott Smith. I mean, I don't like
one's alive and one's not.
Yes, that is a big difference. But I mean, in terms of their talent or their contribution to, you know, art, and I mean, so to my mind, I don't really understand why a commercially successful writer or painter or whatever can get these grants, and someone as successful, you know, at the commercial level in the field of music can't. I'm not talking about necessarily Beyonce, but somebody who's more like a middle class or up, you know, whatever, even upper middle class musician.
Well, are you familiar with the Canadian system? Because we've been sort of impressed, Jason, with Canadian artists coming here with records. You know, they're well-known artists, maybe not Arcade Fire, but the next level down, you know, bands like Stars or whatever. And they come in here and on the back of their record is, you know, funded in part by the Canadian Music Center or the Canadian Music Council. There is government support for making pop music records in Canada. We don't have anything like that, do we?
Not exactly like, I'm Canadian, so I can certainly speak
on
that. We don't have anything exactly like what Canada has, but I don't think we should also romanticize that process either. It's difficult, right, sometimes to get grants. It's difficult for some Canadian artists to break big internationally. There's content laws that, you know, dictate, you know, a lot of what Canadian musicians can and can't do. So, you know, I think, and there's also other countries like Norway and so on that also, you know, do a lot of funding for artists that we could look to as examples. But, you know, I don't think we should romanticize any of those because musicians have difficulty getting their work, you know, produced and promoted anywhere.
Well, it is, as we've talked about already, a rapidly changing landscape, and lots of people still finding their way through it. Lena Simone's article for the New York Times is called The End of Quiet Music, and her latest book is a novel called Note to Self. You'll find a link to her New York Times op-ed piece on our website at soundcheck.org. Jason King is associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. And to both of you, Alina, Jason, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job I offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity.